Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. More than 13.3% of Ohio's households struggled to put food on the table last year. The U.S. Department of Agriculture, which tracks such things, says that that's the highest rate of food insecurity since the federal government started the survey in 1995. The holidays tend to shine a harsher light on this situation. So we're going to talk about it. Joining All Sides to discuss the need in Central Ohio, our Mid-Ohio Food Bank President and CEO, Matt Habash. Matt, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ann. Glad to be
and
here.
And also Worthington Food Pantry Executive Director, Teresa Felton. Teresa, thanks for joining the show.
It's great to be here.
Matt, I gave that percentage, 13.3%. Mm-hmm. What do we know more than that about what the need is?
I think what we're continuing to see need is at an all-time high, and it's not unique to any one community, and I think ultimately what's changing in my 26 years now of being at the food bank really is the growth of hunger in the suburbs. You know, we've had a decentralization of folks of low economic means. We got rid of the big projects and those kind of, you know, housing projects and things like that in the past. And so you see a combination of that, plus a lot of two-income families that have lost, you know, one income goes away, and that wrecks the budget, and we're seeing tremendous, tremendous growth in the suburbs. That's the biggest change I've seen in the last 18 months.
And how's it playing out in the demand at your level?
Demand's at an all. I mean, it continues to go up. It's 140,000 requests for help every month, you know, for people at food pantries. You know, we're continuing to see, you know, an increase at soup kitchens.
And this is in 20 counties.
This is in a 20-county area, so it's not just Franklin County. About half of our distribution's in Franklin County. The other half is in the other 19 counties. And that tracks just about with the demographics of the counties in terms of population. So you get over to eastern Ohio and nine Appalachian counties and Jefferson County and, you know, areas where I grew up, you know, there aren't any jobs over there. And, you know, we're seeing more and more people requesting help. You know, our hunger study tells us 40% of the folks that we help work, you know, playing by all the rules, working, trying to get by, and are having to go to food pantries to make ends meet.
You know, two, 3 years ago, Lisa Hamler, if you get at Second Harvest, mm-hmm. and you and others were predicting that things were going to get worse and worse and worse. Is this what you predicted? Is this what you expected?
Well, nobody can predict, you know, the mortgage crisis and the things that happened in the burbs. I mean, what we saw was that, you know, that there weren't any jobs being created, that, you know, that the middle class job has disappeared. You know, as I like to say, I grew up in Steubenville, and, you know, 40, 50 years ago, people could work in a steel mill, make a good wage, had health care benefits, et cetera, and could raise a family. And we haven't figured out yet, I don't think, what's replaced that kind of job for folks. And so as a result, you've got, you know, food pantries and soup kitchens and folks like were never designed to, you know, take care of working people, you know, and that's unfortunately what's going on right now. And the new wave of that literally is the two-income household. There were ones lost a job, and all of a sudden the budget doesn't work anymore, and they're having to seek help. Somebody described these folks to me the other day as people who a year or two ago weren't using coupons at a grocery store are now using food pantries.
A year ago, they might have been working in volunteering at a food pantry or bringing the cans into work for their own food drive.
We hear that over and over again about the talk about donors, you know, that said, you know, I'm now, you know, I used to be a donor, and now I'm asking for help. And the good news is we're there. You know, we've got this fabulous network of food pantries and soup kitchens, these partners. You know, I can't give, you know, folks enough credit. We don't think about that a lot. And 73% of our agencies are 100% volunteer. You know, they don't have staffs. They, you know, they are people who, by the good grace of God, are there helping people. And literally, most of them are senior citizens. They're 70, 80, and 90-year-olds in a lot of cases, you know. So when demand goes up 40%, you know, over the last 4 or 5 years, you know, that's a lot. Even when we find the food, that's a lot more work for those folks to, you know, have to be able to handle that much more physical labor. So it's a challenge, and it's one that fortunately we've been able to find food, you know, and have been able to get food in the door. I think we're up about 18% over last year in terms of the amount of food we're putting out the door.
My guest, Matt Habash, he is president and CEO of the Mid-Ohio Food Bank, and also with us, Teresa Felton. She is the executive director of the new Worthington Food Pantry. If you have a question or comment for our guests, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Teresa, tell us about Worthington and what you're experiencing. Matt just referenced the suburban food banks. You've got three in Worthington now. What's it like, and what are your greatest challenges?
Well, it's interesting because Matt and I didn't even speak ahead of time, and yet I'm shaking my head the entire time he's talking because it's exactly what we're experiencing is poverty in the suburbs. It's growing significantly. And I just read an article published by the Brookings Institution, and it mentioned that one out of three families living in poverty now live in the suburbs. And that's happened since 2000. There's been a huge change since 2000, at least 25% increase in poverty rates in the suburbs since 2000 alone. So, and that was done, you know, recently with statistics from 2008. So what's happened in the last 2 years even in the suburbs? You know, I think what Matt is describing is exactly what we're seeing. 2 years ago when we started talking about an additional pantry in Worthington, so many people were questioning, we have a need in Worthington for a food pantry, and I questioned it. Got on the board of directors, and like you said, we're 100% volunteer. And the next thing you know, we're reading statistics, we're being approached by Mid-Ohio Food Bank, we're being approached by Ohio Association of Second Harvest, First Link, which is now called Hands On, saying there is a need. Believe us, there's a need. We start getting statistics about the children who qualify for free and reduced lunch programs. We have 2,500 kids in the Worthington School District that qualify for free and reduced lunch programs. And I could go on and on, but what's happened just since we've been in permanent location in August in our Choice Pantry facility, we each month we've grown by another 50 families. We're up to over 200 families that we're serving per month just since August.
What do you attribute that such a steep increase to?
I think a couple things. We did get the word out through the school district this fall, and also visibility. The word is out that we exist. We do treat people. It's pretty cool the way it's set up. It's a choice pantry, and it's really based on nutritional guidelines. But, you know, there's a amount of dignity that comes with this type of food pantry. And I think because people feel comfortable walking through our door, as Matt said, they said, I was the donor a year ago. Many are embarrassed and ashamed. 50% of who we see have never been through a food pantry before and through the doors of a food pantry as a client, but as a donor. We literally, when people walk through our doors, we don't know who they are. Are they a client or are they a donor walking through our doors? So it is, I call it a hidden face of hunger where, you know, there's a new face out there. People are just getting comfortable to walk through our doors. Once they're through, I think, you know, that's what's happening. The word's out and they're feeling more comfortable to walk through our doors.
There's been a real effort to change the culture of what people encounter when they go to the food bank, especially because, I guess, because there's so many first-time people, they're just fundamentally appalled at the fact that they're even there. So, Matt, tell us about some of the ways that the food banks have changed over the last 25 years.
Well, one of the things that we try to do with each of the pantries is really, you know, emphasize with them that, you know, to treat people with dignity. And so we are, you know, constantly looking at, and the choice pantry, you hear that term a lot now. Basically what that means is the client gets to choose food. It's a much more, it looks like a small grocery store. You know, there's a variety of versions, and some of them are on paper depending on the space needs, recognizing that each pantry is different with their capabilities. But the idea is to let the client pick and choose the foods that they really need, recognizing that emergency feeding is still only about 2 to 5% of a pie. You know, so most of the resources are coming from someplace else. Usually their own resources, and then if they're eligible for government assistance, and a lot of these new poor are not eligible. I mean, they still have somebody working and things else, and
they can't get food stamps and that kind of thing.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So the only place they have to turn is to a food pantry to get that kind of additional help. But if you've never had to ask for help before, it is embarrassing and is very difficult to do. This is not, everybody always asks us, you know, are people cheating the system? You know, I don't have time to worry about it because most of these people are so embarrassed to even have to come ask for help. We're trying to get them in earlier. That's one of the things we're encouraging them to do, why you still have resources, because there's no cash assistance for rent and mortgages and, you know, and paying utility bills and those kinds of things, you know, for practical purposes. So, you know, food is the one variable in the budget. And so we're saying, really, as you stretch, make sure you're keeping those other things. Because if you lose your house, you lose, you know, you get evicted. Those kind of things are much, much harder to deal with. So we're really working on a dignity, you know, in terms of trying to do that. We're also working a lot on fresh food. You know, now almost we're shooting to get to 25% this year and 30% shortly in terms of all the food we handle is fresh produce.
You know, how do you do that in the winter?
We partner with food banks around the country. One of the nice things as well is apples and potatoes and onions are staple crops in Ohio. They pick them once, but when stored, they last. We actually have Ohio apples and potatoes and onions just about on into, you know, February, March, sometimes even April. But we bring sweet potatoes out of the Carolinas. We bring grapefruit and oranges out of Texas. We'll bring we brought plums out of California. Whenever it's made available to us from the growing states, we try to acquire that and bring it in.
And people want it?
Oh, my gosh, yes. We really focus on that and appreciate it, especially for Mid-Ohio Food Bank. We also have a couple local smaller grocers that donate their produce and to us each week, and it makes all the difference in the world. We really try to promote the fresh fruits and fresh foods and nutrition as part of the balanced diet concept.
That increases, though, the overhead, doesn't it, for storage?
It does a couple of things. One is it clearly increases our need to do logistics just-in-time delivery to agencies, and so we have a lot more trucks than I ever had. I'm going to be probably approaching 20 trucks here pretty soon. We had five additional rental trucks this year, coming in at various times to try to help get the food just to the pantry just as they need it. Same thing with frozen. We're getting wonderful meat now from the retail store pickups from, Kroger and Giant Eagle and Walmart and Sam's Club, all participating. So we have more meat than we've ever had before. So that also increases then the freezer needs at the agency. So one of the things we did this year, or have for the last, been working on the last couple of years with Ohio State's Glenn School, is a capacity assessment study of all of our agencies. So we've had some help from them. Really looking at what are the needs at each of our pantries and then how do we prioritize those needs to try to maximize the amount of resources that are out there. In some cases, it's bigger space. Some cases, it's freezers and coolers. Some cases, it's volunteers. Whatever it is, we need to identify that, and there's no one easy answer. We have 535 charities in 20 counties we're helping. They all operate differently, so we're trying to assess that and then trying to figure out strategies to meet those needs.
How important is it that you let them all operate differently?
From our standpoint, it's extremely, I'm a firm believer in letting the community and each community respond to their needs in the community. Going in and doing something to a community is exactly that, doing it to, as opposed to getting the community to step up. So, Mid-Ohio Food Bank has no desire to go into a community and start a food pantry, as much as we want to partner with somebody in that community that knows who the people are, knows what the issues are, and then we can go beyond a food pantry. So the benefit bank that, we've had in this community has absolutely been phenomenal.
Tell us about that real quick.
It's a software program that we train counselors, volunteer counselors across the state of Ohio, and then so you can go in, you put in your financial information. We can do taxes. We really want to make sure people are getting their earned income tax credit from that perspective. And then it's about 20 different programs that you may be eligible for, including even up to helping you do your – if you put all that data in there, you can populate the financial aid form for college – the FAFSA report, mm-hmm. Food stamps is a big one, a lot of the healthcare programs, et cetera. So it's a case where us making sure people are taking advantage, of the resources that they're eligible for and know about them. So it's really been a wonderful way for us to connect. We also have full-time SNAP food stamp. They call it SNAP federally. We call it food stamp or food assistance in Ohio. But basically it's food stamps. People out making sure people are signed up, that they know they're eligible for that, that they sign up for HEAP, that's to help extend their energy assistance.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So really, it's been a wonderful program.
We have to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue our conversation with Matt Habash of Mid-Ohio Food Bank and Teresa Felton of the Worthington Food Pantry. We'll get to your calls and your emails, 614-292-8513. If you'd like to give us a call, you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. And you can go to our Facebook page as well, All Sides with Ann Fisher. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Work is piling up. You have errands to run, and you're just downright exhausted. Recharge your batteries with Classical 101. We offer the best classical music 24 hours a day and 7 days a week, so the music you want to hear is available when you want to hear it. It's Classical 101. Classical music all day, every day.
And this is WOSU 820 NPR News. It's 26 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:20 this morning. Cloudy skies today and a high of 34 degrees. A slight chance of rain and freezing rain mixing with snow tonight. Cloudy skies, a low of 27. A few clouds for Wednesday and a high of 36. And looking ahead to Wednesday night, cloudy skies, a low of 21. All Sides continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides. My guests are Matt Habash of the Mid-Ohio Food Bank and Teresa Felton of the Worthington Food Pantry. It's the holidays, and demand is up, and miraculously, so are some of the donations, but there's still not enough. At holiday time, they want to give people a little extra something for their holiday meals. They're record-breaking numbers now. If you have a question or comment for Matt or Teresa, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And I wanted to talk a little bit about the whole volunteer situation, Matt. Sometimes people think it's just give food or give money or give food, and there's a huge volunteer component. There's a huge need, and as the volume of need grows, so does your need for help. You need more help. There's more boxes to pack. I read that the Ohio State University football team or members of the football team came in. You said packed 800?
It's over 800 boxes of holiday boxes that we had. We had a wonderful donation from American Electric Power. They gave us $300,000. We bought food with all of that money. And we had volunteers, and they couldn't have been at a better time. I mean, they literally, because they're big, strapping guys, and they did a lot of work in a hurry, packed over 800 boxes for us in the couple hours they were with us for the one afternoon. But, you know, that's indicative of, you know, we had 10,000 volunteers in our new space in the past year come in. That's an increase from over 7,000. We went up 10,000 hours. Good news is we have space, we have product. You know, we've been finding product that needs to be rebagged. So we get oranges in, and they come in big bins. You know, we get a great deal on them. Bring them in from, you know, Texas usually, and have volunteers bag those up and get them ready to go out to people.
And as far as ages go, I know my kids' hockey team volunteered at the Worthington Food Pantry.
Yes.
Tell us about the different people that volunteer there and what your needs are, Teresa.
All ages. We definitely have high schoolers there weekly that help on a regular basis. We have retired citizens, obviously, that we depend on as regular volunteers. But we really need volunteers in all capacities on committees, on our board. We're constantly building the structure of the organization to make sure that we're meeting all the facets of the needs. But, definitely people can contact us, especially after the first of the year. Some of our seniors head to Florida.
Okay.
And we need more help to fill those needs.
Layla on Facebook wanted to know if – she says they're always looking for volunteer opportunities that their whole family can participate in. Do you have families do that?
Mm-hmm. Definitely. We have a number of families. We've got a great program for young kids. We have a Kids Pack program for kids that are too young because we start at middle school, and you know, I'm careful in terms of safety in the building in terms
sure.
of who we have. So our middle schoolers are the age group in which we start. If they're younger than that, we've got a Kids Pack program. We've had a number of kids that have foregone Christmas presents, birthday presents, brought in donations, you know, and said, we really want to help. We've heard there's a need. So they've started really young. I would encourage a family, if they really want to volunteer, if they call us, we'll connect them with a food pantry in their neighborhood first. If they want to come to the food bank, great. But, you know, one of the things we really are going to concentrate on is making sure that each of our agencies has enough help and are identifying. A lot of them get them out of their congregations. They're faith-based.
Mm-hmm.
But when that's not the case and they don't get enough, families can step in and help.
614-292-8513. You can give us a call and talk with Matt Habash or Teresa Felton. John, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm really not sure how to ask this question because when I hear that there's a lot of faith-based groups involved, I'm wondering if there's any political groups involved. In other words, and this is just a question, could you possibly ask people who come to the food banks, are you registered to vote? And here are a list of issues that are currently before Congress or the state legislatures that we want to make you aware of. Or I guess what I'm asking is, do your corporate donors, do they dissuade you from injecting any kind of political action into the process?
Well, I can answer one step of that, at least. What we do at the Worthington Food Pantry and any pantry that signed up as an Ohio Benefits Bank counselor site is part of that web-based system is to make sure our clients are registered to vote. And we definitely encourage that step of the process. Matt, do you have more?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we really are trying to do with one of our organizational strategies is to mobilize the public. And part of that is there are people beyond, you know, when you talk about opportunities for people that want to volunteer, you can do that if you're willing to write letters, if you're willing to call, if you're willing. There's been a number of key issues. You know, when the farm bill comes up, you know, everybody talks about the subsidy side of that. Well, the other side of that is all the assistance programs, and so we're heavily involved in that. Child nutrition was just passed recently.
Right.
You know, and we've been working on that issue. So there's plenty of opportunity there. There will be lots of opportunity in the state budget process. We get $12 million through the food banks in Ohio that gets plowed back into Ohio farmers. That food is absolutely critical to us. So letting people know how important that is, you know, our state legislatures and the governor's office knowing that that program, if you cut that, you're not cutting my operating budget. You're taking 34 million pounds of food out of the system that we're using right now to feed people. So we encourage that. You know, I'm real strong about hunger is not a partisan issue. It's a bipartisan, you know, we really want, but we need bipartisan support to continue to address it, the issue. And we encourage people. So more of what we're going to be doing is mobilizing the public to really get involved, both at a community level and at a government level, to make sure that needs are being met in their community.
Has the dynamic changed at the State House, given the fact that so much of the growth is occurring in the suburbs where it hadn't before, the growth in need?
I think one of the things that's been very positive is that, you know, when you talk to state representatives, when you talk to state senators, they get it. Mm-hmm. They understand that it's their constituents that are hurting regardless of where their district is right mm-hmm. now. You know, we can talk about it being hidden in a lot of cases because people don't want, they're embarrassed. But the reality of it is somebody knows somebody right now that they go to school with, they go to church with, you know, it's in one of their groups, it's on their block, that has lost a job, is struggling, and has got some kind of major mortgage issue or something going on. And as a result, I think people are far more attuned to, we've got struggling families playing by all the rules in this economy, trying to make ends meet, and we need to step up as a collective community and make a difference.
614-292-8513 if you'd like to give us a call now. If you would like to give a call to the Worthington Food Pantry, 614-985-1766. The Mid-Ohio Food Bank is 614-274-7770. We'll post those numbers. We'll post the links to their websites as well on our website at wosu.org/allsides. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org if you want to communicate with us that way. And Adam, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My question is, I have a piece of property that's in Columbus, and I believe that it would be farmable. It's probably a couple of acres, but I'm not a farmer, and I don't have any clue as to how I would go about that. And so the thought would be, could I donate that property for, not the property itself, but for the use of it as a way to grow renewable fresh vegetables that somebody else might farm and donate?
That's a great question and suggestion. Actually, one of the things that we are going to do, we're putting together a meeting right now, is there's been a tremendous growth in community gardens, and the idea of urban farming is also catching on. We are real interested in that. We have a community garden on our property, you know, and we're going to host a meeting with a conservatory after the first of the year to really look at all of the fresh food initiatives, the kind of things that are going on in the community, what's working well, how do we replicate those, build on those. So we would be most interested in talking to you about the space that you have and what may be possible. We might even be, you know, looking at having some equipment. We're pursuing a partnership with the YMCA about farming some of their land and having youth actually do the farming. So we've got some real interesting things cooking for next year, literally, and would be interested in talking to you about that.
So how would I get in touch?
Easiest thing
to
do, if you want to call me at the food bank at 274-7770, and we'll get, you know, we can connect and see where the land is and what may be possible.
274-7770.
That's correct.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks, Adam.
Thanks, Adam, for the call. 614-292-8513 if you'd like to give us a call, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. I want to remind that my guests are Matt Habash of the Mid-Ohio Food Bank and Teresa Felton of the Worthington Food Pantry. We have an email from Stacy. She says, is donating at the grocery store when you check out a good way to give? Do the food banks receive all that money or just a portion of it?
We receive all that money. It's a great way to do that. We're trying to figure out every possible way, and the grocery stores have stepped up. I was in the other day and saw those wonderful coupons. They'll scan that. We do get all that money. We get it on a regular basis, so it's a wonderful way to help. You know, we get asked the question all the time, would you rather have food or funds? And we tell people to do whatever they're comfortable with. But if it's, you know, frankly, it's easier to warehouse dollars than it is to warehouse food and to transport it around. And we can buy and pick and choose what we need when we need it. But the reality of it is whatever people are comfortable doing. But we can assure you from their end, we're getting all those funds.
And are people generous in that way?
Very much so. I think it's a continuum. It works across the country. It's an easy. We try to make it easy for people. So if you're sitting there, you know, and say, okay, you want to round up your bill? Do you want to put $5, $10 on your bill? It's a great way for us to have points of contact in the community when you're out and about, as opposed to them having to go do something else. It's top of mind when you're standing there because you're staring right at the coupons.
And you already just blew a lot of money, so what's wrong with whipping out another
dollar? That's right. Adding another $5 or $10 is really going to help somebody else have that kind of meal.
But I noticed, and I haven't noticed this lately, but maybe they haven't started it yet or they're not doing it this year, but it used to be that the grocery stores would have sort of bins of bags of food, and you'd pick out a $5 bag or whatever. There's something about that physical, you know, that concreteness of it that makes people get what it is that they're buying, even though it really doesn't have anything to do with what ends up at the food bank.
Correct. We get that food.
You get the food
we
too?
Actually get
okay.
that food if they do that way, you know, where they'll have spirit bags. They've called them a variety of things over the years. They'll make up, in some cases, it's kid-friendly foods. We give them suggestions on what to put in the bags at the different price points for things that our pantries say they are most in need of, and that we don't get donated from somewhere else. So when it's canned goods and those things, those are real helpful to us. You know, because we don't see those kind of package donations as much as we used to, because the industry is getting more efficient. So it's very helpful. As I said, it really is whatever sparks a person to action is really what we're interested in. We want to give them whatever choice they want.
But what you don't want is dated food. You want it has to be. You can't serve people food that's out of date.
Right. We at the local level, at least in anything we get from Mid-Ohio, is already been checked for dates. But when we get donations directly in, it's about 70% of our donations are directly in from the community. And so we do check them. You know, we always joke about how we all have a tendency to take that can of pumpkin that's been sitting in the pantry for 2 years and donate it to the food pantry. Well, you know, we're going to check for the date on that and make sure we remove anything that's expired. But we appreciate anything you give us, quite honestly, because majority is fine and is current. But Matt was talking about, again, you know, we appreciate both sources, the drop-offs of the food, because it gives us the variety of choice to do our choice pantry. And I know that our clients appreciate that variety. But then the finances obviously are always needed, because then we can purchase through Mid-Ohio at a deep, deep discount to provide the perishables that we need, the meat, the dairy, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org, as did Joe. I have been promoting local food production for the past 17 years. Here in Columbus, I started 4 gardens to produce vegetables to be distributed to the food pantries. The technique I use is container gardening. This technique enables people to grow vegetables anywhere. They need not have fertile land. My question to your guest is, why don't you challenge the churches to set up vegetable gardens on their property and produce vegetables for your pantries? Now, I know there are churches that do that already, that have like local little farm trade markets and things like trade vegetables and that kind of a thing. But Matt, any comment?
It's going on. I'm more and more. It's a labor-intensive activity, and you've got to have the right space to do it. But we are trying to figure out. That's part of the reason we're going to do this gardening kind of summit, if you will, or gathering with folks that are doing it, to say, okay, what do we learn? What do you need? You know, how do we help? You know, that kind of thing. If you don't have water, what do you do? You know, those kinds of things. But really encourage. I applaud the person for local food. I mean, to me, that's a big issue. And how do we provide more and more local food? How do we provide fresh food opportunities for folks? Share the foods, trade between each other. I mean, there's a variety of things that go on. And, you know, in some cases, grow flowers and sell them. And, you know, there's, you know, the carbon footprint of flowers is probably worse than food in a lot of ways. So getting those kind of things available, teaching young people, get their hands in dirt. There's all kinds of benefits to this. And we're encouraging people to do it more and more. And then provide recipes and different ways of, you know, particularly if you grow things that are, you know, zucchini and those kind of things, people are don't know exactly as much to do with those as they do with, you know, what to do with the potato.
Exactly. And we definitely depended on the summer gardens, and we have a community garden at our rec center in Worthington that a portion of it's devoted to the food pantry. So I think, to answer your question, Joe, it is happening. I think more and more people are approaching the local pantries and saying, how can we set up a community garden?
Now, Worthington Food Pantry's moved. It was at the Methodist Children's Home, and now it's...
It's at the OSU Harding campus on the east side of Worthington. And well, the other neat thing about that is we partner with OSU Dietary, the dietitians, to help us set up our pantry to make sure it's nutritionally based and based on the USDA food pyramid. So,
and it gives you the storage facilities you need and
yes.
that whole
yeah, it's
thing.
Been a fantastic relationship.
614-292-8513. We have about a minute left. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. One last topic, though, is non-food items. That's a big, things are expensive.
We've always handled them one way or the other, but you know, in terms of, you know, Procter & Gamble was one of the largest donors nationally, so we had cleaning supplies, we've had diapers, toilet paper is the fastest moving product in our system. I mean, just think about it. You don't have to think too hard, but it's the reality, and we encourage people, because the people that are on fixed incomes, those are expensive items.
Right.
You can't use food stamps to purchase any of those kinds of things, so all of the soaps, the detergents, any of that stuff, and diapers in particular and toilet paper are absolutely critical.
Yes, we definitely include that as part of our choice pantry because exactly what Matt said, even if you do qualify for food stamps, which a lot of our clients are in that gap between, you know, eligible for food stamps and yet not making a living wage or on a fixed income, it's not going as far. So regardless, though, even if you are on food stamps, you cannot purchase personal items and paper goods.
Matt, during the breaks or before the show started, I think we were talking about the long-term nature of this crisis. It's not going away anytime soon.
I don't see anything on the horizon that's putting people back to work, particularly in the folks that we're helping, you know, the people that are at the lower end of the middle class that are coming in. We're not coming up with jobs that are going to put people back to work, that are going to pay them a wage that they can support themselves. And when you get out in my other 19 counties, Eastern Ohio, Appalachia, Steubenville, and those kind of areas, you know, further east, there's nothing out there at the moment. So the challenge, it's going to be a long-term process. And I think we've got to have to come up with the caller talk about mobilizing the public and, you know, and getting people involved. And we've got to get some new systems in this country, and you know, deal, this healthcare issue adds to it. You know, if we're going to be looking at the state budget, and you know, they tell me Medicaid's 40% of the budget, you know, and they're going to be restricting Medicaid. What does that do to all those people and their access to healthcare and issues? This is all interrelated. You know, hunger is not an isolated situation. It's all related to the issues that people face economically. And as a community and as a country, we're going to have to come together and take a really good, hard look at ourselves in terms of what do we really want to be, you know, in the next decade.
I agree with Matt, too, with that real quick, is transportation issues. You know, the jobs are not where they need to be in the suburbs or where the people are living that have need. And once you try to add on those transportation costs to try to get to where the jobs are, you've got another dilemma.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank my guests. I hope you'll come back and join us again sometime. Teresa Felton of the Worthington Food Pantry and Matt Habash of the Mid-Ohio Food Bank, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks,
we'll be right back to talk about a new children's book that tells us all about Columbus, Ohio. I hope you'll stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Time is running out for you to make your 2010 tax-deductible contribution to public radio. Your support helps ensure that WOSU will continue to serve Central Ohio listeners in 2011. It's simple to make your pledge by December 31st. Give online at WOSU.org or call 1-866-897-9678. Your contribution has never been more important for the future of public radio. Thank you for supporting WOSU this year.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. And in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, Hour 2 of All Sides will discuss Arizona, which recently cut funding for transplant operations. We'll hear about the impact of state budget deficits on state Medicaid programs and hospital charity programs for the uninsured. Join us for that discussion beginning at 11 right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. It's 26 degrees in downtown Columbus at 10:40. Cloudy skies today and a high of 34 degrees. There's a slight chance of snow mixing with some freezing rain tonight. Cloudy skies, a low of 27. Cloudy skies for Wednesday and a high of 36. Clouds Wednesday night, a low of 21 degrees. And some sunshine for Thursday, a high of 31 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Before we get too far into the show, about a little peregrine falcon, I wanted to give the audience a sense of what a young peregrine falcon really sounds like. Let's listen to this clip from the Ohio Department of Natural Resources website. Sounds like an excited, busy signal on my phone, but imagine that's the call of a peregrine falcon chick, frightened from a fall from his nest high up on a ledge of the Rhodes Tower in downtown Columbus, where he lands. When he lands, Packard, the chick, sets off to find his way back home. In so doing, he travels to almost every major attraction in and around downtown Columbus, from the State House to COSI to the Columbus Museum of Art. Author Susan Levine has combined two interests to tell the story of Packard, a love of Columbus and a love of nature, and she has joined our show to tell us about her new book, Packard Takes Flight, A Bird's Eye View of Columbus, Ohio. Welcome to the show.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Susan, why?
Why
this
did
book?
I write the
yes.
book? It's really very simple. There wasn't one. I was helping my children's teacher put together a field trip to go visit the State House. Most fourth grade classes have to study Ohio history and study the Columbus as our capital. And I helped put together a field trip to go downtown to visit the State House and see some other sites. And I thought, gee, I'll run to the library and grab a picture book that the teacher can read the day before the field trip, and lo and behold, the librarians told me that there wasn't one that existed.
And even if there had been, it might have been outdated. You really, I mean, this is all updated with the latest on the Columbus Museum of Art and everything.
Yes, I tried to make it very up-to-date. One of my original visions was to have this in conjunction with the bicentennial, which is coming up. Columbus's 200th birthday is in 2012, mm-hmm. and I thought this would be a great way to segue into that. So I tried to include some new things, like the Scioto Mile that's under construction right now and will be ready this summer, as well as the Art Museum and its great new expansion and update that's going to be opening in January.
How did you come up with the idea of a peregrine falcon to tell your story?
Well, I knew I wanted to write a story about Columbus, a fictional story, and I needed a character. And I just remember hearing about the peregrine falcons, or I knew it was some type of bird that was nesting downtown that had been in the news. And so I called the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, their Division of Wildlife, and I spoke with a wonderful person, Donna Daniel, who has been a great help to me throughout this whole process. And she told me about their website, and I read up on the birds, and I thought, gee, this is a character that will be appealing to kids and will be a great vehicle for taking people around the city and sharing with them all the wonderful things that Columbus has to offer.
You know, we got that sound clip from the Ohio Department of Natural Resources, and we'll put a link to the ODNR's website on their peregrine falcons on our website at WOSU.org/allsides, so folks can go and learn more about the peregrines. Tell us what happens with Packard.
Okay. The story of Packard is that he is a juvenile peregrine falcon, and he's just starting to get his brown flying feathers. They're born all white. He's just starting to get his brown flying feathers, and he's kind of exercising his wings and showing off for his brother and sister way up on the Rhodes Tower on the 41st floor where their nest is. And a big gust of wind comes by and blows him off the ledge. And that is something that actually can happen to the little peregrines. Some of them have been rescued here and there on the State House lawn and things like that. So it really is based on something that could happen to one of the falcons. And he falls off of the 41st floor, and he happens to land in a truck, the truck bed on the street below, and the truck happens to be taking a big bundle of colored balls to cocci. So that's the first place that Packard ends up is cocci. And so he visits cocci and he learns what there is to do there and has some fun. But then he always, every place he goes, he always sees something that kind of reminds him of home, or he gets homesick. And he's determined to find his way home, and he goes outside and jumps on a bus or something and kind of is always hoping he's going to end up back at the Rhodes Tower.
How did you decide what to include as far as the sights?
Well, I really just picked places that I enjoyed going with my own children. We always loved cocci, the art museum, the Santa Maria, the North Market, the State House. So those are places that I enjoyed going with my kids, and I thought people would like to take their kids there as well and learn about them. I also included one unique place that I think is a real treasure in Columbus that not that many people know about, and that's the Topiary Park.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really a unique, neat place, and I'm glad I included it.
He's just kind of passing that by when he's stuck on a bus or something, isn't he?
Yes, he doesn't actually stop there. He's kind of passing by on the bus, and he sees it, and he says, oh, gee, that's someplace I'd like to go back to.
614-292-8513. Give us a call and tell us what you think are the special sites in Columbus that folks ought to know about to bring their kids. That's a good time. The holidays are upon us, and the kids are home. If there's something you want to do with them and you want to learn more, give us a call. You can go to the website at ODNR, and they do have a link to Susan Levine's book, Packard Takes Flight, and you can see what she's talking about in there. One of them is the Franklin Park Conservatory, 2 miles east of downtown. It's probably my favorite illustration in the whole book, Susan.
Yes, it was actually the first one that Erin did. The illustrator is Erin Birchwell, and she's from Canal Winchester, just south of Columbus. And when I was looking for an illustrator, she offered to do a sample picture for me, and the conservatory is the first one that she did. And I just loved her beautiful style. She's a watercolor artist, but she gets very rich colors. And if you look at her original artwork, it's very three-dimensional. Some different things are raised, like if you look at the conservatory picture, the butterflies are raised up, and so that's why her pictures have such depth and richness to them.
And how did you decide what would be in each picture? Because, for instance, in the conservatory, there's a little chihuly in there, there's the butterflies, there's the water fountain, there's just a little bit of this and that.
Well, she looked at what I had written, and then sometimes we made a few changes because she would say, oh, I really would love to put this into the picture, because she would go to each of the sites and mm-hmm. take pictures. And so there are a couple places where I actually changed the story to accommodate what she wanted to put into the picture. But more often than not, she would read the words that I wrote and put those things into the picture, so the story and pictures went together.
I think my next favorite is the painting at the Columbus Museum of Art. The woman with a big red hat and a face as emerald green as the leaves on the trees below his nest.
Yes, that has always been one of my favorite paintings at the art museum, and my children as well, and so that's why I really wanted to highlight that. The other thing that we feature in the book about the art museum is the wonderful chess set.
Mm-hmm.
It's by Joan Vopes, a local artist here in Columbus, and it is magnificent. They had it out in the courtyard. They weren't exactly sure where it's going to be in the new building, but it is definitely worth seeing. It is really, really neat.
Now, Susan, how old are your children now?
My children now are 15 and almost 13.
How old were they when you conceived this idea?
Well, fourth grade.
Okay.
Because that's when my daughter was in fourth grade. Mm-hmm. And I kind of had the idea earlier because my son had been in fourth grade. But it was really when she was in fourth grade that I said, you know, I'm going to do this. I can do this.
And what do they think?
Oh, they're really excited. And my daughter actually has really been a big help. She was one of my editors, and she came up with some real good ideas that I've actually incorporated into the book, like making the little characters that Packard meets at each location give them a personality, like the French painter at the art museum or the army ants at the Santa Maria. And I thought that was a really clever addition. And she also would tell me a few times when I would put some kind of phrase in, she'd say, "Oh, Mom, that's just out. That's not cool anymore." So she probably saved me a few places there as well.
Have you ever written a book for children before?
I have not, but I've read many, many, many books. I love to read to my children. And so I had a pretty good feel, I thought, for what kids would like and how to put together a book that would really appeal to the children and the parents as well, and fill the needs that the teachers have. The book is a fictional story about Packard and his adventures, but on each page where he visits a particular site, I've incorporated a sidebar that has a picture of the outside of the building, for example, the state house, and then it has some facts. So the children, the adults, whether it be a teacher or a parent, can learn about that particular site and impart that information to the kids as well.
It feels like it'd be a great book to go exploring with your child with.
Well, and I think it's a great way to empower children. I've had many, many people this holiday season buy the book for either in-town children or even out-of-town children, and with the promise of, gee, this summer or after the first of the year, look through this book and read the story about Packard and decide where you'd like to go. So I have lots of grandmas and aunts that are going to have children visiting them this summer, and they're going to be setting the itinerary based on the Packard book, where they'd like to go in Columbus.
Where is it for sale?
It is for sale in many of the local bookstores mm-hmm. around. Cover to Cover has it.
In Gahanna?
It's actually in
Clintonville.
Clintonville.
Right, sorry.
Cover to Cover in Clintonville has it. Many of the Barnes & Nobles have it. The Book Loft has it. Also, the gift shops in many of the sites that are featured in the book. For example, the State House gift shop carries it, the Franklin Park Conservatory gift shop, the Art Museum gift shop, the Zoo gift shop, and then some specialty stores like Larson's Toys have it as well.
That's in
That's on Lane Avenue
and the Lane Avenue Lincoln. Shops.
Right, right. And then if people would like a signed copy, they can always go to my website, and I'm happy to sign a copy.
The different venues must have been kind of tickled about this book.
I think everybody was very excited to have a book about Columbus that featured all the great treasures that Columbus has to offer. And that's really one of the things that I enjoyed most about writing the book was, one, the people I met at each one of these locations, and the things that I learned. I thought I knew these places pretty well, and everybody had some interesting, fun facts to share with me that I didn't know before.
You know, the North Market, I guess I was surprised, but happily so, that you included the North Market in there.
Oh, I've always loved the North Market.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of my favorite parts of the story, where Packard sees the bird, sees the chickens in the case there, and says, "Oh, gee, my mother would be so proud of me if I could catch one of those chickens. I know I can do it," and they're already pre-plucked. So there's some humor there, but the children, again, are also learning about how peregrine falcons hunt, what they hunt, what they eat, the fact that they do pluck the feathers from the bird that they catch for the babies before they feed it to them. So I was always trying to incorporate things into the story where the kids were learning while having fun. And that's always been my whole philosophy. As I raised children, as I was the Cub Scout leader and the Brownie leader and helped at schools, I was always trying to find ways to make learning fun and the kids not even to realize that they're learning.
Let's take a call, and then I have a couple more questions. 614-292-8513. We have just a few more minutes. Gloria, welcome to the show.
Hi. Yes, very interesting. Can you tell me, what is the appropriate age group for this book?
For children to read it themselves, it's geared towards third, fourth, fifth grade. But
okay.
Certainly children younger than that can really appreciate it if they have someone to help read it with them.
Okay, great. All right. Thank you very much, and thank you for writing this book.
My pleasure.
Thanks,
okay.
Gloria.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Susan Levine, author of Packard Takes Flight, do you think perhaps parents in the suburbs maybe don't get downtown often enough, and this is a nice little intro for them as well?
Well, I think it could be. I hope that people will use Packard Takes Flight to go on vacation in their own city, because you're right. Sometimes we don't take the time to explore what's in our own backyard, and Columbus has so much to offer, even things beyond what I've included in the book. This is really just a snapshot of all the great things in Columbus.
I feel like there's got to be another Packard book out there, because I was wondering, what did you have to leave out?
Oh, my gosh, there's so many things that I had to leave out. The Wilds is one of my favorite places. That's a little bit further on the outskirts of town, over in Zanesville, but I love that. And I love all the things down in the Hocking Hills, and there's wonderful places just all over central Ohio. So maybe Packard will take a vacation sometime.
Well, now that he can fly.
Absolutely, absolutely. And what's interesting is that the birds that are part of the Peregrine Restoration Program, where the Rhodes Tower nest started, they also put nests in Toledo and Dayton and Cincinnati.
Relatives.
And these birds, they travel around and visit one another. And because of the bands on their legs, they can tell when they sight some of the birds that have been born in Columbus. They've seen them in Michigan and Canada and places like that, which is really fun. In fact, the new female bird that's kind of hanging around the nest right now, our female bird last year was killed at the end of the summer, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the new bird, Durand, it actually has a leg band that says she was born in Ontario, Canada.
There you go. It's a whole series of travel books. Susan Levine, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure. It was very fun.
Susan Levine, she is author of Packard Takes Flight, A Bird's Eye View of Columbus, Ohio, illustrated by Aaron McCauley Birchwell. That's all the time we have right now. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.